and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte. Skinny Jason Stark is against humanity.
Take away the human elements of Starkville.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. Even in times like these, I still write about baseball for The Athletic. And as always, I am joined by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, and distinguished former major leaguer, Doug Glanville. So, Doug, before we get to the big stuff, the Red Sox resuming the baseball season, the most unlikely homer of the 21st century. I understand that there is breaking caulking news in the Glanville household. So let's go to our man on the scene, Doug Glanville. Doug, what's the latest?
Yeah, I like to add to my resume, and I've now added caulker. Is that an actual title? I don't know, but it sounds good. I'm a caulker, yes. I've learned about many different tools, and my bathroom, the tub upstairs was a little bit leaky, and I had to, order stuff, how that is, and wipe down packages, and then boom, I actually finally executed my caulking skills. And I feel like I'm kind of a natural. I feel good about that. I felt very excited. No leaks. The bathtub did not fall into our kitchen below. So that is success. So I feel great about it.
You executed your caulking skills? Did you even know you had caulking skills?
Didn't even know it. Absolutely. But the scouting report clearly omitted it. And that was an oversight by the National Scouting Bureau, which used to exist. So yeah, I'm very excited about this.
Yeah. Doug, you know what you need right now? You need caulk-up music. Do you have any caulk-up music we could cue up?
I should have jammed a little bit more than I did. I realized I was so focused. I had the fan on, so, the fumes and all those things. But if I could think of stuff, I would pick something like Huey Lewis and the News, because they had a song, Stuck With You. So, is that right? Stuck With You? Yeah, Stuck With You.
I think that's enough.
Is that it? Yeah, they have a little harmony in the back. Yeah, they performed in Iowa when I was in AAA on my birthday, so I feel like I'm connected to Huey Lewis.
Here in the Stark compound, I don't have anywhere near that kind of dramatic news. I can tell you that I did do some power washing. That was a success. The side of the house did not fall off, which is what I expected. So that went well. I performed a little emergency tech support on my wife's computer. That only ate up like 3 hours. But thanks to the magic of YouTube, I am now a hero around here for that. But otherwise, very little drama here since I spoke to you last. And Doug, let me be the first to assure you, that's a good thing.
Yeah, right.
Know what I mean?
No doubt.
It's helpful to be useless, by the way. I'm not asked to do much. Now, this week on Starkville, Ken Rosenthal will once again make it through customs and visit us here at Starkville to talk about the Red Sox, the latest on the return of baseball, and a really cool story that he just wrote on the pitchers to get the final out of a World Series. We're also going to relive the magic of one of baseball's most spine-tingling moments, Bartolo Colon's home run. Then we will talk about how clubhouses handle the changing of the guard. And finally, we will have more important Field of Dreams news. But first, Doug, we have some people to thank. The doctors, the nurses, the first responders who've been so heroic over these last couple of months, thank you to them. The people who continue to deliver our mail, our packages, our groceries, thank you. The people who continue to go to work at supermarkets, the truck drivers, the trash collectors, thank you to them. To my friends who continue to gather local news at so many newspapers across America, I think I've mentioned I now subscribe to 10 local papers from coast to coast. So if you can, please subscribe to your local paper. We've never needed local news more than we do right now. And finally, I want to report that the Starks gave this week to Garth Brooks' Teammates for Kids Foundation, which is part of baseball's home plate project to provide meals for children. Gave to them over the weekend. Got a nice thank you note from one of Garth's friends just today, in fact. Also gave to Phil Abundance, which supports food banks in my hometown of Philadelphia. I just feel like there's so many people in need right now, and if you're employed and you can help, that help matters. It's what we're doing in our house. Doug, I know that you and your wife continue to sew and distribute face masks, and not even just in Connecticut, correct?
No, wherever. And it just happens one of our children's godmothers is an ER doc in D.C., so she kind of responds to that. But, you know, she's turned it into more of an on-demand if people request it. Because now the word's out a little bit around certain circles. So they say, hey, you know, she can sew. And she'll move on from masks. She does caps and, you know, whatever is needed. So, you know, that's been hands-on. It does speak to what she said about the local. You know, it's easy to kind of get into that bubble to a certain degree, but not always realizing the sort of scope and magnitude just to sort of deal with it. But that access of information locally is so key to just understanding what's happening in your communities, because it seems like that's the way we're kind of get out of this, right? We're going to kind of move from a inward place to sort of expanding out as we open up more and more. You know, really, my wife is just an incredible at sewing, and she's always been. She's taught classes, so it's nice to feel that hands-on connection, helping out a physician, someone really are on the front lines of this.
Well, that is so special. So thank you to her. Again, if you can help, there are so many people out there right now who need our help. All right, Doug, it's time to welcome back Starkville's favorite guest. It's our good friend, Ken Rosenthal, who continues to do amazing work at The Athletic. And Ken, looks like they let you through Starkville customs again, huh?
Without even getting my temperature checked.
Okay, then. That's, you know, if we can't believe in Ken Rosenthal, who can we believe in? You know, Ken, you've now visited us so many times. I've got big news for you. My understanding is you have now been elevated to our prestigious Rayon Elite status. I believe that means you're now eligible to use our personal Starkville concierge service. So let me tell you what that entails, my friend.
I'm listening. I'm all ears.
Okay, we can make you a reservation at the Starkville Diner, where you'll remember you've already qualified for a free dessert. We can get you tickets to the Starkville Playhouse. Although you should probably know in advance, only one man shows there. Right. I do hear that the evil mayor has been known to appear on stage, but I'm guessing that's mostly to enforce curfew. And we can help you book all your future travel to Starkville. But just so you know, if you also want to leave, you're on your own for that trip out of Starkville. Right. Yeah, so what do you think, Ken? Quite an honor, right?
I don't know that I'll sleep tonight. It's just thrilling beyond belief, beyond words, actually.
You don't sleep anyway. You're always working. We're on to you. All right. Speaking of work, let's get serious. Major League Baseball finally announced the results of its 3-month investigation of the Red Sox last week. Ken, I know you're also making an appearance on our great podcast, The Lead, on Tuesday to talk about this, but I appreciate you stopping by Starkville to chat about it. In case people missed it, this turned out a lot different than the Astros. The manager in Boston, Alex Cora, not disciplined beyond the 1-year suspension he got for his role in the Houston cheating scheme when he was bench coach. The president of baseball operations for the Red Sox at that time, Dave Dombrowski, not disciplined. The Red Sox players, much like the Astros players, not disciplined. So it turns out only JT Watkins, the video replay system operator, gets suspended. And he's suspended for 1 year. Beyond that, Red Sox docked a second round draft pick and the slot money that goes with that from their draft pool. And that's the extent of it. So, wow, Ken, so many questions. First one, feels to me as though MLB totally corroborated the reporting that you and Evan Drellick did for this, for The Athletic in January. But over and above that, it looks as if the players gave them such conflicting stories, they had a hard time sorting out what went on and who should be held responsible. Now, you did so much reporting on this story. What were the aspects of MLB's account of what happened that jumped out at you? And did anything surprise you or differ from what you had heard in your reporting?
Nothing really surprised me in what they found, because we believed in what we reported. That, simply put, the Red Sox were using the video replay room during games to decode signs. And during games is the key part of it, because you're allowed to decode signs through video before and after games, but it's during games and then using that information that is prohibited. So that's what we heard. That's what MLB heard, but they heard it 100 different ways if you read the report that Commissioner Rob Manfred issued. And that was the problem. They couldn't get to a place where there was necessarily full agreement. And ultimately, their decision was, as you said, Jason, to penalize Watkins, to dock them the draft pick, and that was it. So when I read the report, the thing that jumped out at me initially was all of this was being laid at Watkins' feet. And that, to me, is not right, necessarily. And it just surprised me to see that, because while I knew the players would get immunity, while I knew the penalties would not be as severe as what the Astros received, simply because what we reported was not as egregious as what the Astros did, the fact that it got laid at the feet of the video replay room operator, that surprised me.
Yeah, I really don't understand that. I mean, I'll be honest. If I played for the Red Sox, look, I know you really have to use your imagination to assume that happened, but I'd be embarrassed right now that JT Watkins is the guy taking all the heat for this. I mean, let's use logic here. There's no way that guy acted alone. He had to be communicating constantly with coaching staff, with players, and I'm guessing with people in that front office, and yet he's the only one disciplined. And meanwhile, the people who played similar roles in the Astros scheme got no discipline at all, still work there. So can you help with that? Can you help us figure why that is?
I can relay what MLB's explanation was. And that essentially is that JT Watkins was a rogue employee who was not acting at the behest of the front office or the manager or the coaching staff, and who was doing this on his own. And if you want to paint the picture, it's basically players coming back there to the replay room, which is very close to the dugout, at least in Fenway Park, although this continued on the road too, and him giving them information that he was not supposed to give them. Now, one of the confusing things here, or one of the mitigating factors, it seems, and Manfred mentioned this in his report, JT Watkins was involved in two different things with the Red Sox. He was involved in their advanced preparation, which involved decoding signs from video before and after games. And he was involved as the replay room operator. He had two different jobs that kind of converged in this area of decoding signs. And it was difficult for him to know when maybe to draw the line, even though he claimed he was aware of the rules and understood the rules. And even though he fervently and vehemently denied any impropriety on his own part. So a couple of things I should say here, Jason. Keep in mind that when we did the Astros report, we had an on-the-record whistleblower, Mike Fiers. We had other corroboration as well. And once the report was out, we saw guys like John Boy on Twitter put together videos corroborating what we had reported. With the Red Sox report, and we knew this from the start, there was no on-the-record whistleblower. That led to, in my view, these conflicting accounts. And it made the task for MLB that much more difficult, because you couldn't simply say to the players, hey, guys, we got this. You cannot run from this. It happened. in this particular case, it was not the same. So I understand MLB had a greater challenge here, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, the thing that really jumped at me the most, besides what I said about Watkins, was Rob Manfred. After the Apple Watch incident in September 2017, in which the Red Sox and Yankees were fined for using electronics illegally, in case of the Red Sox, said, "I am going to hold the manager and GM responsible for future infractions of this kind." When he penalized the Astros in his written report, he referred back to that statement and said, "I'm going to hold the manager and GM responsible. That's why, one reason why we're not penalizing the players." Here, all of a sudden, 180. Watkins is a rogue employee. We're not going to penalize the manager further. He was already getting a year suspension for his conduct as the Astros bench coach. And we're not going to penalize the man who was the GM at the time, Dave Dombrowski. That really jumped out at me. I found that to be incredibly curious. And the rogue employee explanation, I get it, but I have a hard time buying it.
Yeah, I know Doug wants to ask you about these inconsistencies too, but you know, you mentioned his two dueling roles or his joint responsibilities.
Yes,
one as the video guy and one as the replay room guy. Who put him there? Right? Who asked him to do those jobs? Right. He didn't just decide he was going to do that as a rogue employee. Right? Somebody put him in that position.
And other teams had guys in similar kinds of dual roles. So this goes back really to baseball implementing the replay room in 2014 and not anticipating certain consequences that would result from having replay feeds or live feeds coming in and the question of what teams would do with those. So we can rip them for that and criticize them for that. And to a certain extent, we've questioned it at the very least. And it's fair to question baseball for not seeing the future a little bit better than they did. But the Red Sox, again, were not alone in having one person in this dual role. And clearly that was a problematic position for a guy like JT Watkins to be in.
Yeah, no doubt. Doug, yeah. I know you have some questions on this.
Yeah, I mean, the inconsistency strikes me. And you talk about, just from the punishment and right leadership. I mean, that was a big theme in the Astros, right? Even if, you know, okay, Crane didn't know, whatever, you know, they seemed to give them this hall pass that they didn't have direct knowledge, but they still were held accountable. So I don't know how they don't, you know, make that same connection here. And I'm wondering yeah, go ahead, Ken.
No, I agree with you. And granted, the Astros culture was a major issue in their misconduct, and Manfred pointed that out and kind of excoriated them for the culture, which was top down, not going up to Crane in their view, but certainly from Luno down. And in the case of the Red Sox, they basically said, no, the Red Sox front office did a great job in relaying rules to the non-playing personnel, the manager, the coaches, etc. And that was not a problem. They set a culture of accountability, etc. Well, okay. Maybe they did. But that message didn't get through to the players, because on page 10 of the report, this is the one other thing that jumped out at me. It said most players did not seem to understand the rules in 2018 and 19 and what was prohibited and not with regard to in-game decoding. Yes. So
it's amazing.
So right. That's a problem to me. I don't see how that adds up.
Right. And I think, Ken, think about the players from the standpoint of the silence, right? So it's going to take an inordinate amount of silence and sort of code is under this code for nothing to sort of come out as this is the final pass, right? Okay, we've done our investigation. For one, if you're a player on the Red Sox and you care about these other sort of teammates really who are helping you, video room, trainers and so on, you don't want to throw this guy under the bus. All right, and you know what happened to a large degree, even if there's, you know, slight differences between whatever information they gathered from players. But you're also thinking about the opponents. I mean, the opponents know things, right? There's a lot that they know about what went down to a certain degree. Maybe it's not as clear. You know, the Astros had the whistleblower. That was sort of the defining difference. So I'm curious, and what you found, do you think that the rest of baseball is going to kind of take this lying down, like in terms of players or, you know, Red Sox players that might be a little bit conflicted? Do you see other information coming out to kind of impeach this either process or result?
Doug, that's a great question. And I can't foresee that happening if it hasn't happened yet. I know what we've written. I know what Evan and I wrote the day after raising a lot of these questions. And I have a general sense of what else has been written by others. And we haven't heard much from the players. Now, granted, reporters don't have access to players in the same way right now. But for whatever reason, and maybe it's because we're in the middle of this pandemic, which is slightly more important than any of this, this story and these penalties have not gotten the same attention as the Astros did. Also, they were less glamorous penalties, if you want to call them that, or less stringent penalties. So I'm not sure where it goes next. And what was interesting to me also, if you remember, the Red Sox players consistently, after our initial report came out, not only denied it, but said it was absolutely wrong, and they did nothing wrong, everything was fine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this speaks to them not knowing the rules, which, of course, the commissioner points out in his report, but we have not heard much from them either. Do they feel badly about Watkins? Now, again, we don't have access to players right now the way we normally would. If I were covering the Red Sox beat, I would be calling players and asking these questions. I don't know if that's taking place or not. So, again, it's going to be really interesting to see once play resumes how the Red Sox are regarded and how, Doug, as you point out, this is a great point, how they feel about what happened to Watkins, because he took the hit for all of them.
You know, I want to get back to Alex Cora, because we touched on this, we danced around this, we didn't really look at it closely. A.J. Hinch, the manager of the Astros, got suspended for a year, even though Rob Manfred's report said he didn't participate in, he didn't even condone what went on there. And yet, Alex Cora wasn't disciplined at all for his role in what happened in Boston. So, Ken, help me with this. You just said it. The commissioner had said, even before the Astros verdict, that he would hold team leaders responsible for what went on under their watch. Do you have any level of understanding why that principle didn't apply to Alex Cora in this case?
It goes back to that rogue employee explanation. And that is the explanation I was given when I asked that question specifically and pointedly after the report came out. Now, that is an explanation, but even if you look at it that way, to me, you've established a pattern for how you're going to punish people in these situations, in illegal sign stealing cases. And they abandoned that in this particular case. And I don't know that the rogue employee explanation is sufficient enough to abandon what you had said previously. What you've said previously is we're holding the manager and GM responsible. They're in charge. They are the ones who have to make sure everything is on the up and up. Now, to get back to one of the things you said previously, Jason, a dugout, and I think Doug can speak to this, and I'm going to ask him to. A dugout is a beehive of activity. If there is a replay room located maybe 20 feet behind the dugout, and if players are coming out, transmitting signs out to second base, relaying signs out to second base, and player on second base is relaying them home, often that can be done legally, as we all know. But at the same time, if there are any shenanigans going on, it stands to reason that somebody's going to know about it in that dugout besides the person doing the relaying. And in fact, it stands to reason that a coach or a manager or all of the above would know. So this, Doug, is the question I have. How does this happen? How are these things taking place without any knowledge at all from people in uniform in charge?
Right. I mean, it's preposterous. I mean, it is. I mean, first of all, the expertise to even break down the significance of the signs, you always want that player insider input on, you may, you know, on this data that's being sort of extracted, right? You always want that because otherwise you're getting misinformation to your team. How does it skip from him and then mysteriously not get translated? That's seemingly impossible, right? I mean, someone communicates something, like you said, whether it's the second base, for it to be some advantage, right? Relaying it. So I just don't know how you have no clue what's happening at all. I mean, that doesn't really make sense. But there is a connection to this rogue concept, because what does a rogue allow to happen? It sort of bookends something. It closes the chapter, even if it's artificial, because, you know, think about what it means to Major League Baseball to have 2017 World Series tainted and then 2018 right back at you. If, you know, players are suspended, coaches are suspended. I mean, now you have two whole seasons that come into doubt. And that is tragic for baseball. So they're going to be very careful, needing 100,000% proof evidence before they're going to do anything that sort of makes it seem like that trophy was also tainted. And I'm curious going forward how they're going to be able to, you know, keep it in a certain sort of in a certain light, because any player that's upset by this is going to eventually talk about it, and they better be ready for that.
Right. You know, and a couple other things I should point out as well. The report on the Red Sox, both our initial report and the commissioner's report, neither of them stated that they did anything during the 2018 postseason. This was just regular season. And the other thing is, people have asked me, why didn't you guys report on other teams? Why was it just the Astros and Red Sox? Why do you have it in for them? Not a case of that at all. Those were the two teams we were able to confirm this kind of activity. Did we hear it about other teams? You bet we did. Did we try to get this information confirmed on other teams? Absolutely we did. And ultimately, whether you want to consider it a reporting failure or whatever, we just couldn't get there. And there's a certain standard we have to meet to report something. If we don't meet that standard, we're not going to report it. And I don't think people want us just going out there haphazardly accusing teams. I've seen a lot of that on Twitter and other places, but we don't do that. So do I think this is the end of it or was the end of it? No, of course not. But this is what we came up with.
And I think Rob Manfred ran into what you and Evan ran into, what reporters run into all the time, is that when you ask people what happened, you don't always get the same story. And it was so obvious from reading the report that players told Major League Baseball conflicting stories, several conflicting stories. It was really hard, obviously, for Rob Manfred to sort out in his own mind what happened. And I think, you know, his background is as a lawyer. He'd already established a kind of a standard of proof in the Astros case. There was no whistleblower. There were conflicting stories. It was difficult to come to a consensus on who did what other than one guy in the video room. And I think that had a lot to do with what he concluded. He basically concluded that he couldn't reach a conclusion. I think that came through loud and clear.
That's true, Jason. And you're right. The commissioner's office and the Department of Investigations in baseball is held or follows a similar standard to what a reporter follows. It's not exactly the same, but yes, they cannot simply go willy-nilly and haphazardly pick out facts that they want and issue discipline based on hearsay or that kind of thing. They have to, as they did, conduct exhaustive investigations, try to be as fair as possible. And I tend to believe that's what they did. I do have questions about this, and the questions will remain in my mind, and they're not going away until I get better answers. But I'm not saying and would not suggest that there's anything untoward here. The differences in the investigations and what actually happened with the two teams was quite significant. And that is what, as we've been talking about, really led to unique challenges with this particular investigation.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, one more thing before we move on. It feels like the consensus in Boston is, hey, Alex Cora basically got exonerated in this report. So we'll see him back in the dugout with the Red Sox a year from now. You think it's safe to conclude that?
I think it's reasonable to speculate about it. I don't know if I would actually conclude it, but the Red Sox did not rule it out. And Sam Kennedy, their president, gave one answer on a conference call with reporters the first night the report came out, basically saying, hey, we need to give Alex Cora a chance to rehabilitate himself. And I do believe in second chances, but he stopped there. He said this penalty, and Chaim Bloom said the same, was for his conduct with the Astros. That is why we ultimately parted ways with him. It was not because of his conduct with the Red Sox. In fact, that decision was made only a week after our report came out. It had nothing to do with that. It was strictly on the basis of what Cora had done with the Astros. So that being said, nothing changes in a year. He is still the guy who did what he did with the Astros. And if you want to bring him back, I guess you could rationalize people get second chances all the time. And Alex Rodriguez is no finer example of that in Major League Baseball. But at the same time, I would ask, if you fired or parted ways, however terminology you want to use, with Alex Cora because of what he did with the Astros, how does that improve in a year? Simply because there's a year's space between it? Simply because this report, I don't know, exonerates him? Because it doesn't completely exonerate him. It definitely says that he did not relate the rules well enough to the players. You want to go ahead? You go ahead if you're the Red Sox. But you also have a GM who was not the GM when Alex Cora was the manager in 2018 and 19. That's Chaim Bloom. And Chaim Bloom might want his own manager. So I know there's clamoring among fans and even among media in Boston for this to happen. And I understand that Alex Cora, dynamic manager, extremely successful manager, a guy that obviously is really good at his job. But I don't know if you're the Red Sox in the front office and ownership, how easy that would be to justify other than saying, well, he's great and we're going to have him back. Whatever happened, just happened. That's a difficult task, if you ask me.
Now, you know, everybody knows that Doug and I worked with Alex at ESPN, and we know what a bright, charismatic guy he is. He left his mark on so many different aspects of the Red Sox and that whole organization, not just on the baseball team. And so a lot of people who have a great authority within the Red Sox understand the impact that he can make, that not every manager can make. And I'm sure yes, that's in their mind. It should be in their mind. The other difference is, true, they parted ways with him based on what happened in Houston. But they also parted ways with him almost knowing with certainty he was going to get suspended, right? For a good part of this year. And it was going to be very difficult to continue with him as the manager. And in a year, that is not the case now that this has been resolved. So,
no, I agree with that, Jason. And I don't want to come off sounding too harshly.
No, I know.
Because people do deserve second chances. And you know what? Alex Cora and the Astros, for all we think about them, they were reacting in the same way that other teams were reacting, out of paranoia. Now, I'm not excusing it. That's the last thing I'm doing. But it was the culture of the game at the time. The Astros clearly went a step beyond everyone else from everything we know. But does that mean you banish Alex Cora forever? No, I don't believe it means that. And at the same time, I just have a little bit of an uneasy feeling at this drum roll or drum beat for bringing him back when it seems to forget what happened at all. And I, frankly, at times with Alex Rodriguez, I wonder, why are people forgetting what happened in the past? There were things that happened to you. But that said, again, I'll go back the other way. I do believe in second chances. And you know what? Alex Rodriguez is not hurting anybody right now, and people seem to like him. Alex Cora, same thing could be said, and he's certainly popular in Boston. So if they want to do it, they can do it. But there are other factors in play here, the GM being one of them, and the fact that he did some pretty tough stuff with the Astros being another.
Well, is that suspension effective 2020? I mean, when does it?
It ends at the end of the 2020 postseason.
Right. So if there's no baseball played this season, nothing. Basically, you start. where it still ends, right?
Yes, yes.
So, right.
Like everybody, AJ Hinch will be eligible to come back next season. And I believe AJ Hinch will come back next season perhaps as well, but not with the Astros. It will probably be with another team.
Yep.
Yeah. Like we could talk about this all day, but
yes.
let's look forward. We're going to flip the calendar to May this week, which means we're about to finish our first April without a Major League Baseball game since 1883. And I'd like to believe that at some point this year, we're going to see another Major League game. Ken, what's the latest that you're hearing on how and maybe even when baseball could return or at least attempt to return?
I believe we're going to play. And I have thought that for some time now. And what I tell people is, I don't know how, I don't know when, but I just know that there are powerful motivators for baseball to resume. And they are financial in many senses for the players and the owners. They are also, if you want to call it patriotic, for lack of a better word, and the fact of having baseball back and using it as a distraction while people are still somewhat shut in, that's a powerful motivator as well. And the government at the state and federal level is involved in that. And we all know, of course, why it's so difficult for the sport to return. The pandemic and the differences in the impact of the pandemic in different places around the country. So where are we? My understanding is that baseball is considering a variety of plans right now, not just the Arizona plan. In fact, the Arizona plan might be on the back burner, but other plans in which they would start in multiple states, perhaps quite a number of states, depending, of course, upon which states are open and which governments are comfortable and which scientists say this is okay. It's not easy to figure out. They, it seems to me, are operating with an abundance of caution. Baseball doesn't want to come back too early and have it fail, and would rather come back late, even if it means missing 2 weeks you could have had. So it's all going to evolve, and I believe in the month of May, we're going to get some more answers. A lot of this is predicated on increased testing and the availability of testing. And as we've seen in our country, we do not have enough tests, and we are not, at this point, able to administer a sufficient number of tests to have a professional sport come back the way it should come back. So that's a very long way of saying, I don't know what the heck is going on, but there is stuff going on.
Yeah. And the plan that, that got a lot of attention last week was the three-state plan, where rather than just open in Arizona, you'd have games in Arizona, you'd have games in Florida, you'd have games in Texas. I agree with you. I'm hearing that there actually are potentially more states than that involved. But here's one of the aspects of that plan that I think people haven't really focused on. As opposed to Arizona, which is in the Pacific time zone, Texas is in the central, Florida is in the east. And if this is basically going to be a TV show, you need to have teams playing in their own time zone as much as that's possible. And that's why I think don't you think that's why you see baseball looking around for multiple options in multiple time zones?
Yes, that is one factor for sure. And ultimately what drives this is what is feasible. And when you determine what is feasible and what you can do, then perhaps you take a stronger look at the TV aspect of it. But until you have feasibility, then you have nothing, right, Jace? So
exactly.
Even if you have a not necessarily desirable set of circumstances with regard to time zones, not perfect, you're just going to have to live with it. We're going to have to live with an imperfect schedule. We're going to have to live with a lot of imperfection once the sport comes back. And one of the other things that I keep hearing, but I don't know how to wrap my head around, is, all right, let's say you start in the three states, those three that you mentioned. Good plan. What happens when you want to expand to the home stadiums? How the heck do you implement the travel all at once and suddenly just go whoosh here we go. Go to
right
this state, that state, and the other state. That is an idea that people are talking about, kind of slowly coming back to life, like the country, right? But I don't know logistically how that happens. And it's one of the many questions that we'll have as we go forward.
Yeah, baseball's obviously talking to the medical authorities. And yes. Right, what happens if they say it's safe to play in some states, it's safe to play in some home parks, but not all of them? What happens then? You got a schedule. You got to have some order to this season. Do we have any sense of what happens if that's the case?
No. And if anything, I've heard that even states that are going to come online later than most, New York and California, they're going to want some involvement, even though initially they might not be involved. Well, if that's the case, again, that comes to a scheduling question. How do you make it work? Can you eventually have fans in the ballpark? This is something the Yankees president, Randy Levine, went on the record on Fox Business last week and said, right, it's not practical to play a whole season without fans. So can you open up your stadium to a limited number of fans at some point? All of these things are unknown. And with this virus, we've seen that no one seems to know really or have a complete understanding of what is going on with the virus itself, much less how you open up and how you do all these other things. So, Jason, we've talked about this for a while now, really, since the shutdown. Okay, you want to come back? Great idea. We'd love to have you back. How the heck do you get back? And that kind of is still where baseball is.
Yeah, and you still have to deal with the players, you know, personal issues, their families. Sure. And, you know, and the fact that we have, you know, 50 states, these borders, trying to make them into sort of like these sovereign walls is an illusion, right? They're jurisdictions, and you're going to try to stop, you know, a fan in Oklahoma to go to Texas. I don't know like how that works exactly. So it's going to be really complicated. And then the fact that is, you know, if you're the Mets and they're saying, okay, we'll have the closest state to you that's open is Florida. You know, how exactly is that going to play out? It's a mess. But I think as more information comes out and we get closer and closer to kind of getting on the other side, it just gets clearer. But logistics, you're going to need 10 PhDs in logistics just to figure out how to get people places. So we'll see how they pull that off.
And travel alone is just a major issue. And that's why the three-state plan, Texas, Florida, Arizona, makes some sense at least to start. Because you can limit it to bus rides, right? You can basically start with those three states, have the teams, 10 teams in each state, right? And just have them play each other. And that would take, I don't know, several weeks. And then you figure it out from there. But again, as you said, Doug, the logistics, it's just really hard for anyone to know what will work, what will transpire. And I will say this, Jason, I might have said this on this podcast before, but one thing that is going to drive me crazy when we get back are the fans who are going to complain about their team getting the short end of the schedule. Right. Folks, right. It's not a normal year, okay? We're not going to have everything buttoned up. Let's just deal with it. It's a season with an asterisk already. If your team gets jobbed, your team gets jobbed. We try again in 21. Right.
Ken, I wish you luck trying to impose that moratorium on fans complaining. Good luck on that.
I'm just getting it off my chest already.
Okay, well, that'll give us some storylines to explore with you next time you come to Starkville. But guess what? We're not going to let you leave yet because we got one more thing to talk to you about, and that is your latest piece, which I absolutely loved, about the last 10 pitchers to get the final out of the World Series. So fun. I'm really, to be honest with you, I'm a little jealous of this great idea. That's because one thing I have always tried to do at all the World Series that I have covered was find that guy who threw that last pitch and ask him to describe it. These are men who are literally living every pitcher's dream. And you talk to 10 of them. I'm just curious, of the 10 pitchers that you got to speak with, what was your favorite tale?
The one that made me laugh the most, I think, was Wade Davis talking about Citi Field in 2015 and coming into the game, I believe, with a 7-2 lead. And it's in the extra innings. So it's really over. The fans at Citi Field are filing out. The Matt Harvey experience had not gone well in the end. It's been great for eight innings. And he said he couldn't believe he was basically coming in to get the final outs of the World Series to an empty park. And it was kind of silent. That was one of the things that I enjoyed the most listening to. Jason Mott talking about the look on Yadier Molina's face. Actually, each one of them had its own elements of really cool memories. And it's funny, Jason, you know this, we do this all the time. We're always looking for good stories. And the day I was at Nationals camp, I talked to Hudson and we talked about the final out because I was just curious what he remembered. And then I talked to Doolittle about it because he had been the guy who might have come in but didn't. And then I thought, you know what? It's a good story, but it'd be even better if I can talk to more of these guys. And Jason, you're so right. That is something that only, I believe, 94 pitchers have had that feeling in the history of the game. And there have been more World Series than that, but some guys have done it twice or multiple times, and some, of course, never did it at all in certain World Series where there was a walk-off hit. But to talk to the 10 of them, all different guys, all different kinds of pitchers, it was just a really neat thing to do. And just to hear what they have to say, because so many times with the World Series, and Jason, you're good at this, but few of us are, capturing the whole moment and relaying to people what exactly happened. And the final out often gets lost because maybe there's not that much drama. Maybe other things have happened. Maybe it's a team like the Nationals where there's so much going on. You can't write about the guy who just recorded the final out. And that guy often gets lost. Yeah. So to go back and talk to these pitchers, it was really enlightening to do that. And I'm with you, Jason. I remember at the end of the World Series last year, I'm in the Nationals clubhouse for Fox, not yet begun my writing reporting. And Fox is saying, who are we going to get? Who are we going to interview? We want you to get one guy. And we'd already interviewed a number of players on the field and a number of players on the set. And I said, this is obvious, guys, Daniel Hudson. Now, Daniel Hudson's not the biggest name. So there was a little bit of hesitancy in our producers' minds, but they said, go ahead. And Daniel Hudson is an amazing story. Two Tommy Johns, released at the end of last spring, traded to the Nationals. I mean, it goes on and on.
Wife had a baby in the middle of the playoffs.
Wife had a baby in the middle of the playoffs. So these guys, I mean, they're all individuals. They all have their own stories. Of course, there was the great Bumgarner performance in 14, all of these things. And it was just really neat to bring them back to life.
Yeah, I've had so many memorable conversations about that last out with so many guys after so many World Series. One of the ones I really vividly remember is the Madison Bumgarner episode, because when he came in that game on 2 days rest, he completely owned whatever happened the rest of the way, right? Completely. Yes. And like, they weren't planning to have him pitch the rest of the game, but how could they possibly take him out? So I remember talking to Dave Righetti, the pitching coach, after the game, and I said, what would have taken for you to take Madison Bumgarner out of that game? And he said, well, if he got in any trouble at all in the ninth inning, we were going to go get him. And I said, hey, can I remind you that the tying run was on third base? as Salvador Perez came up there. And Dave Righetti looked at me and he said, oh, he wasn't going to give up a hit to that guy.
Well, it's so funny, Jason. So one of the things Bumgarner said, probably the most revealing thing he said, was that as Alex Gordon ran around the bases, eventually stopping at third, he was backing up home plate. And he said he was already talking to Posey about what they were going to do with Salvador Perez while the play was going on. Now, that's pretty good. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. You know, when we talked about this story last week, I mentioned something to you that I found fascinating for quite a while now. It's just unbelievable how often the guy who throws the last pitch is not the same guy who started the season as the closer for that team. And you and I then went through it, and it turned out it's actually the last nine pitchers in a row, as you mentioned in your story. And so, Doug, I'm going to bring you in here. We're going to go through it. I want you to try to guess along with us as we name the nine pitchers who got the last out try to figure out who started the season as the closer. You ready to play our game?
I will get beat down on this one, but I'll give it a shot.
We all will, Doug. All right. Well, it's shocking in some case.
Yeah, 2019 Nationals. We already mentioned Daniel Hudson.
Yeah,
Who started the season as a closer? It's easy. Sean Doolittle. We'll move on.
Yes.
2018 Red Sox. Craig Kimbrel was the closer, but who got the last out? Come on, Doug.
Who did get the last out?
It was a starting pitcher.
A starting pitcher? Oh, man. Chris Sale? Who got
Chris Sale got the last out. Manny Machado strikes out on, goes to one knee. This one is over. 2017 Astros. Ken Giles started out the season as the closer.
Okay.
Who got the last out?
Who did get the last out for the
Astros? Ken, you better help with this one.
Initial CM.
Also a starter.
The son, he's the pitcher who's the son with a lot of sliders.
Good question. Good thought, but no.
Charlie McCullers.
Oh, yeah. Morton. That's what I was thinking, McCullers.
All right. So 2016, I know you know this one, Doug.
Yes, that's Mike Montgomery. I got that. The Cubs closed it out.
Okay. Who started the season as the closer that year?
Oh, boy. Who was the closer?
I had to look it up. I could remember. Hector Rondon is the answer.
Oh, Rondon.
God.
That's amazing.
Yeah. 2015 Royals. You already mentioned Wade Davis.
Yeah, Wade Davis closed it out.
But he was not the closer when the season began.
It was a guy who was with the Rockies who went to
Greg
the Rockies.
Holland.
Yes, Holland. Yes, Greg Holland.
All right, 2014, Mad Bum gets the last out. Who started as the closer?
Romo.
Yes.
All right.
Very good. Now one.
Very good.
2013 Red Sox. This was hard.
Goodness.
You will never get this one, Doug.
Never.
There's no chance.
Yeah. Koji gets the final out. Who was the closer their first game that they won?
How about like Daniel Bard?
Good try.
Go ahead, Ken.
Joel Hanrahan.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Is that insane?
Yes.
All right. 2012.
Andrew Bailey, and then they went to Koji.
Oh, yes, they did. 2012 Giants was Romo with the last out, but who was the closer when they started?
Who was the closer for the Giants? Melanson or something?
No, pre-Melanson. Brian Wilson, of course.
Oh, yeah, the beard. Fear the beard.
And then 2011 Cardinals, impossible. You mentioned Jason Mott got the last out. But who got their first save of the year?
Oh, first save of the year, Cardinals.
I think it was
unfair, Jason.
Yeah, it's unfair. I think it was Mitchell Boggs, right?
Boggs?
Fernando Salas was a
Salas.
He had a run real early on as the closer, right? But they didn't even. I mean, they really didn't even have a closer till Jason Mott kind of got it rolling.
My goodness,
that's 9 years in a row.
Yeah.
Of the guy getting the last out, not being the opening day closer. And you think about all the effort and the thought that these teams put into who's going to close. And then we have this. Ken, what does this mean? Does it mean anything?
Playoff baseball.
It means, yes, that there is a lot of churn in pitching staffs over the course of the year. It also means that we've seen in recent years teams increasingly willing to use their starters in relief in the postseason as they shrink their staffs. So it is telling, and it is indicative of the trends in the game, yes.
I mean, teams aren't even declaring closers. That's the other thing. They start off the season.
Right.
And more they're not even saying who's the closer. I don't know. We'll see. So it used to be you have to have this anchor, but now it's – you know, situational. So it sort of makes more sense going forward, but it's amazing how far back it goes.
Well, you know, I have a motto. Like if I were the king of baseball, I would not allow any manager to say during the postseason, well, that's how we did it all year. Because
right,
doesn't matter what you did all year. Exactly. You know what does matter? Win. Win tonight. Win that game.
One game.
Win the World Series.
And actually, Jason, it's a great point. And more teams have gone to that. You don't really hear managers the same way we once did. I did this a whole year. I'm going to do it again. And there's a certain logic to that as well. You don't want to disrupt the dynamic of your team. But increasingly in recent years, definitely managers have said, we're throwing out the playbook. We're going to do whatever it takes. And it's led to some creativity and it's led to some funky guys picture at the end of the game.
Yeah, and it led to a great piece by you. So there you go. We actually unearthed some meaning. We didn't even know we would. So
how about that?
That was impressive. All right, we're gonna let you get out of here now. We're gonna let you out of Starkville. I'm gonna guess that after a trip to Starkville, being quarantined has never looked so good, right?
Well, they say, Jason, you can check out any time you want. You can never leave.
Yeah, especially here. I warned you about this. I warned you about the concierge.
You did.
Right. You're welcome back here anytime, though, if you can find our concierge.
Being here. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Great to have you. And be sure to check out Ken's appearance on The Lead on Tuesday for more on the saga of the 2018 Red Sox. Doug, as we mentioned last week, I'm writing a series of really fun stories on the strangest but truest games of the 21st century. Last week here, we talked about the crazy home run by Benji Molina, in which he didn't even score a run on his own home run. We're not going to go through that again. This week, I told the tale of a home run that I think we can all agree nobody on this planet saw coming, including the guy who hit it. It was back in May of 2016. Bartolo Colon stepping up to the dish. I want to relive this uplifting moment one more time with the great Gary Cohen on the mic for SNY.
Colon looking for his first hit of the year. He drives one deep left field. Back goes Upton. Back near the wall. It's out of here. Bartolo has done it. The impossible has happened. The team vacates the dugout as Bartolo takes the long trot, his first career home run, and there will be nobody in the dugout to greet him. This is one of the great moments in the history of baseball.
Gary Cohen, man, so good. Love that call. Great. Now, Doug, let me give you a few fun tidbits on Bartolo's homer. First off, slowest home run trot ever recorded by a pitcher, 32.6 seconds. Now, we haven't been recording home run trot times dating back to 1876, obviously. We have StatCast data. It goes back a few years before that. The late, great Tater Trot Tracker began timing these trots in 2010. So, had never been a trot slower before, hasn't been a trot slower since. Also, Bartolo was older when he hit his first home run than Hank Aaron was when he hit all 755 of his 755 home runs. It was classic. I talked to Kevin Plawecki, who was the catcher that night and who had also doubled right before the homer. And he almost missed third base because he was so excited to get home and watch the trot. And he told me, boy, that would have been bad if the homer doesn't count because I missed third base. Thank God I touched it. So that was tremendous. And you heard Gary Cohen call it one of the great moments in baseball history. So I'm going to ask you, Doug, what do you think? Was this one of the great moments in baseball history?
I mean, it's taken a life of its own. It's become art. It's become history. It's become what I'd call physics. First of all, the trot was not just because only because he was enjoying it, but because physics demanded it. That's all the speed he's got. So, but yes, the fact that he would always wear a helmet 18 sizes too big every time he was hitting, and it would fall off. watching his at-bats was just sheer baseball entertainment. I know even Commissioner Manfred talked about it. Like, you know, you have to start looking. It's like Michael Jordan playing hoops, and then there's Bartolo Colon at the plate, and you kind of start to weigh and see some sort of equivalence in there. So all of us paused to watch this at-bat, and we recognize that we witnessed greatness. We witnessed the equivalent of, as you mentioned, Haley's Comet. And you always have to savor moments, because that's what baseball gives us, these rare moments that you have to let marinate into your soul and until you're still talking about it 100 years from now.
Yeah. Embedded into this column I wrote is a YouTube video that's quote-unquote highlights of Bartolo hitting. And it's really like 3 minutes and change of his helmet falling off. It's right. So good. It is sheer entertainment. Now, I polled Twitter on who hit the strangest home run of the 21st century. Was it Bartolo, based on comic relief alone, or was it Benji Molina, based on not scoring a run in his own homer? Before I give you the results, Doug, tell me how you would vote.
I have to vote Ben Molina. I mean, because strange, the fact that he literally did not score, he was some sort of apparition or something, that in and of itself is just beyond strange. So I'm going to go with Ben Molina on that one.
Yeah, I think strange, Benji wins, unpredictable, unlikely, absurd. Bartolo would win any of those. But we had about 2,000 people vote, and Bartolo crushed it, Dougie. Oh, just wow. Crushed Benji. 68.6% of the votes went to Bartolo. Tolo,
wow.
31.4% to Benji. It was a stunner, man. Stunner. We're both stunned. I know that. All right. I want to ask you about Bartolo because, you know, you guys actually had the same rookie season, 1997. Somehow or other, he outlasted you by 14 years. How'd that happen?
Yeah. No, I came up 90. Well, that was the thing about me. 96 was my technically rookie year. And I thought in 97, when I hit 300 that year, I thought I was going to win the rookie of the year for a lot of the year at a certain point. And Scott Rolen won it. But then I realized that I wasn't even eligible because I had used up my eligibility.
Oh, the year I thought before. It was the opposite. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I got that right. Yeah. So, so Rolen, so I had no chance. I wasn't even in there. So that's a sidebar. But yeah, the fact that he played 14 years beyond me, and it's just like unbelievable. My hamstrings were falling off after like 10 years. So yeah, crazy.
If he just could have stayed in shape like Bartolo.
Right. If I worked out a little more. Right. Right.
Now, you know, I looked this up, and you know, you killed Bartolo Colon. You were 4 for 10 off that guy. Most of that was when he was with the Expos. Curious what you remember about facing him.
Yeah, I mean, it's well, for me, the harder they threw and the more fastballs, I was better. Velocity, so that didn't matter. Yeah, velocity was, I hit those guys well generally. But the thing that was cool about Colon is that he threw like a catcher. You know, coming up in the minors, I always heard about how they taught catchers to kind of throw through your ear. You know, you keep that ball at like ear height and you kind of throw almost darts. And because you're relying on that quick release and pop time. So when you face him, he short arms it. It's so quick on you because you don't have that big wind up and the arm coming way above his head. You almost had these darts. So the ball got on top of you really quickly. and early in his career, he was high 90s. I mean, this guy threw hard. And he had a little two-seam action. So there was late movement. So he was tough to square up. And as you've seen later in his career, he could pepper the strike zone. He just was always confident to hit his spot. So, you know, he was tough then and stayed tough until, I don't know, if did he actually put his, you know, hang up his spikes? I don't even know. He may still be playing somewhere.
So. I checked in with his agent, and he told me that Bartolo would still like to participate.
Oh, right.
So, there you go. Hey, one more in this. Is there a guy, a pitcher that you once played with who hit a home run that you still can't believe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were some good hitting pitchers like Omar Dahl and all that, but no, the one case I remember is Robert Person. If you're out there, Purse, I know you're listening, man. Wow. just like impossible, basically what happened. I know, I think getting this right, he hit a grand slam. First of all, he scored 10 runs in the first inning against the Expos.
He did, right.
And I think he was hurt or coming back from injury. but something where he hadn't played a while, hits a grand slam. In the first inning. And then later, I think it was later in the game, his next at bat, base is loaded. He hits another home run foul. Like it goes foul. God. Like, I mean, almost had two grand slams. And then he hits a 3-run home run later in the game. He had 7 RBIs. I'd never had 7 RBIs in a game. I never hit a grand slam in a game. This guy does both in one game. And I think he didn't get a hit the entire rest of the season or something. I mean, it was just like, what happened? So it was some sort of zone that you can't even explain. It was like out of body type zone. And we heard about it, of course, for the rest of the season.
I might have to include this in my Strange But True series. You know, he, a couple things. The second homer was the bottom of the fifth. He was coming out of the game. He wasn't going to pitch, but Larry Boa was the manager then and said, what the hell? Let's let him bat one more time. And he hits a 3-run bomb, right? So he circles the bases, does a curtain call. That's all we see of Robert Person that night. Slam and a 3-run homer. And the slam in the first inning, off a reliever, by the way.
Reliever.
It's only the fourth first inning grand slam by a pitcher in the history of baseball. And I looked this up. Nobody has done it since. So the only three to do it were Camilo Pasquale, Tony Kloniger, and Dave McNally, plus Robert Person. So I think this fits our definition of what this was. Unlikely.
Yeah.
Okay, Doug, time for that portion of the podcast that we both look forward to. It's listener trivia. It's our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. We'll tell you how that works shortly. But here comes this week's question. So many great ones this week, but we love this question from Jim Doughty, whose trivia handle is at JimDoughty41. So that's at JimDoughty41. He asked this fun question. The last home game and last homer for one beloved star was also the first ever postseason appearance for his legendary teammate. I'm guessing he became a legendary teammate, probably wasn't that legendary then. So what was the game, and obviously who were the players? One reason that I love this question is I was dying to know the answer. Such a fun thought, right? So I feel like this has to involve the Yankees, which means there are so many possibilities, right? I've thought about this one, and I'm going to go with 1951, I believe, is the year. Joe DiMaggio would be the guy on the way out of the Bronx, which means Mickey Mantle would be the guy on his way in, playing in the postseason for the first time. Like, I know that happened in that World Series. The only question is whether DiMaggio hit a home run in that World Series, and I don't know that. Doug, you have a guess?
Whew. Man, that's tough. So last home game, hits a home run or last home run, and then some shining new person on the scene is about to have this incredible career.
Right, you get it, right?
Oh, wow. At first I thought a junior, but then he finished with the Reds, right? Where did he end up? Or the White Sox?
No, he wound up back with the Mariners.
Mariners, okay. All right.
But it wasn't, he didn't finish up in the postseason, though.
Broken season. Okay, that doesn't work. So that means I have absolutely no idea.
All right, so we want to just go with DiMaggio and Mantle?
Well, I'll go with Jeter or something like that. Last home game. Did he hit a home? I don't know. A-Rod. How about A-Rod? He's still playing. No idea. I'll go with you. Some Yankee history.
That's your answer? Some Yankee?
Some Yankee history. Or Cardinals. How about some Cardinals? Right. Lance Berkman or something like that.
No, you're not even comprehending the concept of this. It would have to be like Musial and Pujols, but that wouldn't be possible. So anyway, you've been useless. Let's bring in the mayor. Any chance that I got this right?
Jason, shockingly, no, you didn't get this one right. What? But what you were right in the fact that it involves the Yankees. And it seems that the Yankees are always near the epicenter of history. But I think we need to hop in the time machine and flash forward to 1995, game two of the ALDS, okay, in which Don Mattingly hit a home run in his final home game in postseason career. And then the guy with the shining armor the night for the Yankees, who would later become the team's pitcher and or closer and Hall of Famer, Mariano Rivera, played his very first postseason game as a Yankee on the last home postseason game that Don Mattingly hit a home run.
Wow. That's a good Don Mattingly home run. That's his only postseason homer. His only one. You know, Mr. Mayor, why don't you perform a little magic? Do you think you could play us that homer? This would be 1995 ALDS. Yankees were trailing at the time. Don Mattingly hitting.
This one by Mattingly. Oh!
Whoa.
Yeah.
Gary Thorne nailed it, but listen to the sound of those people, Doug. Wow. Yeah. Wow. What a moment. What a moment. Woo.
Yeah, Donnie Baseball, legend, man. Donnie Baseball.
Yes, sir. Doug, as you know, we always try to use these questions to inspire some fun topic. Here's where I think we should go with this one. How about the changing of the guard on a team? You know, as the beloved players from one generation move on and then new guys move in. And I know too much about you. So I know that you actually lived through that when you got traded to the Phillies in the late 90s. You were brought in to succeed Lenny Dykstra. Yeah, yeah. And there was just one small complication, if I remember this right. You got to spring training and Lenny was still around.
He was there.
He was trying to play after back surgery. So how'd that go? How'd that change your guard go?
Well, if you're fortunate enough to play long enough, you're going to be on both ends of that, right? You're going to be a starter one day, and then next thing you know, someone's replacing you. So you know that feeling. I remember running into Ryan Howard when I was covering with ESPN some games, and Howard then was a veteran, and he said, look, I know how you feel now when I first got called up. So, you know, you kind of get that full circle. And in my case, I was traded right before Christmas in 97 from the Cubs to the Phillies. And it was a tough day because my grandfather had passed away the night before in the same hospital actually where Buck Leonard was passed. And it was so I was a little bit distracted to say the least. And then I get traded and I should be excited on paper because it was my childhood team, the Phillies. Going, and I knew it was a place I could be assured a chance to start as a center fielder. But I remember when the smoke cleared about the trade, the GM at the time, Ed Wade, was like, hey, look, Lenny Dykstra, it seems like he's hurt, you know, but we're expecting you to go to camp, but there's an outside chance he might, you know, be there and all that. So they weren't even sure he was going to even be able to show up at camp. And when I got there, I looked and he was in the batting cage. I mean, like mid-season form. Whack, 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 whack. I was like, oh, well, this guy looks game ready. So it was a full-on competition. And, you know, there was a lot of controversy because I was like the Philly hometown boy from University of Pennsylvania coming back to Philly. And Dykstra was sort of the old guard chewing on nails and tobacco and shoes for lunch and whatever. So I was just, you know, it was we were different personalities, but we had fun with it because I like Stratomatic. He loved Stratomatic. I had some cards sent to the stadium and we shared them and talked about it. I remember his quote when he had the walk-off home run, said, oh, the last time I did that was in a game I played Stratomatic as a kid. So, it was a friendly competition. I actually, you know, learned a lot on, he had a great eye and he really understood thinking 10 steps ahead. So, it was tough. And that was my welcome to Philly. I came right in, Terry Francona's the manager, and I had to, you know, earn my job, but it raised the bar and it went really well. And towards the end, he kind of packed it up. He's like, you know, that's it. And he's tweeted at me a couple times, some compliments about how that went down. But nails, that was the battle. And that's a tough guy to replace because fans were on me when I broke camp. They were not just handing it to me. There were a lot of Lenny Dykstra fans in Philly giving me a hard time at the vet. But fortunately, I was able to turn the tides.
Yeah. Yeah, Lenny had some Mr. October moments there.
Yeah, sure
the
did.
Phillies. You know, I'm not sure if you watched the Michael Jordan Last Dance episodes this week, but they honed in on Dennis Rodman on Sunday. And I don't know. It did it feel at all like Lenny Dykstra had a little Dennis Rodman in him back then? And, you know, just like an incredibly talented guy with big baseball IQ, but like there was always something going on with Lenny, and that something didn't always involve baseball.
Right. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. I could see that. It, quirky. And he would, if he would make an out his first at bat, he'd like take, change his uniform, his gloves and stuff. Like he just, he superstitious and no question about it. But you knew that just talking through baseball with him, that he was on another level. He really had a great understanding about pitchers and what they were, what to look for. So I get it. I mean, Rodman was just relentless, and so was Dykstra, hence the nickname, right? Nails.
Yeah. Lenny, one of the characters of baseball. Dennis Rodman, one of the characters of basketball. And they still have a presence on our planet. We're not going there. All right. Finally, Doug, we have talked about Field of Dreams a lot on this podcast. And guess what? We're not done. Just this weekend, you texted me a link to a story from Barry Bloom at Forbes.com,
yes,
saying that out in Iowa, the Field of Dreams game scheduled between the Yankees and White Sox on August 13th is still on the schedule. And work on that ballpark on the site of the movie is still taking place. Now, I have a big point I'm going to make on this that supports my view of the iconic nature of Field of Dreams. But first, we need to talk about who really should play in this game. I'm going to nominate Flueless Joe Jackson. Who you got?
I don't think I can top that at all.
I hope not.
I took the time over the last few weeks to kind of look at the 19 White Sox roster, you know, and they have some names in there, man. I mean, first of all, Eddie Murphy and Bill James are on this team. Okay. So just like take a pause. Yes. Like, yeah. So you have like Norbert and you have like the statistician, the sabermetrician legend, Bird, Lynn, Win Knowles or Noise. Nemo, there's a Nemo. How many Nemos were in the big leagues? Come on, that's got to be a short
Brandon
list.
Nemo.
Oh, yes. But N-E-M-O, first name, Grover, Loudermilk, Shane O'Collins, and Red Faber. I mean, I love it. So they had some characters just on their names alone. So I think it's worth bringing that back, and maybe it'd be like the nickname game where you get to wear your nickname on your back. That would be perfect for this game.
when you first rolled these out to me, I asked you whether Bill James thought that Wynn was overrated.
Right, exactly.
And speaking of overrated, here's my real point, because I've been trying to convince you that Field of Dreams is not overrated. So if they're still planning to play a baseball game at the site of this movie, and obviously the construction workers who are building this ballpark are considered essential workers and are still working on it, doesn't this prove my point? Like, name any other baseball movie. And, or maybe any movie where they would still be building a ballpark at a time like this. And you know why that is, Doug? Because people will come, Doug.
They will come.
Play this game.
Regardless.
People will most definitely come.
Well, I hope they wait a little bit until we're ready to come. But yes, I tip my cap to the iconic nature. I will always use the word iconic for Field of Dreams because it means a lot to a lot of people in baseball. And I get it. I totally respect that. And when you can make a game out of it, I played in Iowa for a couple of years. I get it. I understand. We had 10,000 a night at Des Moines in Sec Taylor Stadium. I mean, huge baseball fans. So there is something connecting between Iowa and baseball. I don't know what it is or if before the movie. And so I think that there, you know, when you think of, for example, the Winter Classic, I went to a Winter Classic, by the way. The NHL had those winter games at Wrigley one year. That is a cool experience to bring the game back to this innocence, this part of where you're just playing out in the cornfield, or, you know, it takes away all the illusions and the lights and it brings it back home. And that's an important thing that I think all of us connect through in baseball. And I also think at this time, it's important to get back to some roots and remember why we love the game in the first place. So I'm all for it 100%. And hopefully it happens. But it's something they should not only do one year, they should do that every year. And they should move it around the country so we could see baseball in its real organic form. I think that would be great for the game.
You know what I take from that answer? I've won you over. This case is closed. Maybe not. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Starkville. Like all editions of Starkville, this one is available absolutely free everywhere you get your podcasts. So be sure to subscribe to Starkville on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts. And of course, you can still find us at the Athletic app and the Athletic website. You should know the Athletic has 16 local major league podcasts that feature not just our great baseball writers, but all kinds of broadcasters, former players, and other baseball luminaries. And like Starkville, they are also available free wherever you get your podcasts. And if you thought about subscribing to the Athletic, we are still producing incredible baseball stories even now. We're now offering a 90-day free trial. You can find that at theathletic.com/90freedays. In between podcasts, remember to read us on the Athletic website and on the Athletic app. And also remember that you too can be part of this podcast and achieve those 15 seconds of fame that you have been dreaming of. You just need to submit a trivia question that the evil mayor of Starkville, Mayor Cam, will decide that, boy, this one will make Doug and Jason look like the clueless knuckleheads they are. So then we'll get it wrong. Then we'll use your question to inspire a fun topic of conversation. And you can send us those questions two different ways. You can email them to Starkville, that's Starkville with an E on the end, at theathletic.com, or you can send them in via Twitter to tweet at Doug Glanville. Doug, how would they find you?
Oh, easy. At Doug Glanville, DougGlanville.
And you can find me at Jason St. So that's at JaysonST. Doug, thanks for playing. Cam, thanks for adjudicating. And thanks to you all for listening. We'll see you next week on Starkville.